WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On Friday, a young killer stabbed and shot six people. Before he died, he told us why. He hated women. Call him sick. He was. He was even getting help for it. So that's one explanation. But when his 140-page manifesto showed up online explaining how and why he hated women, the dam broke on an online conversation on Twitter and beyond, women speaking up to say that what this killer said is a dangerous message that is on the loose in our culture and is part of the frequent experience of being a woman living in America, and that this misogyny is fostered by men, average guys, regular guys. Lament or accusation, it deserves discussion. This hour, On Point, a hard look at misogyny. Is a conversation about misogyny in our culture worth having? Whatever led Elliot Rodger to kill, how do we talk about the hatred of women that he himself pointed to as his motivation for murder? Yesterday at a vigil and memorial at UC Santa Barbara, the student group, a cappella group Vocal Motion, gave a performance for the victims of the UC Santa Barbara rampage. Joining me now from Washington is Soraya Shamali. She is an activist and writer on feminism, gender, and culture. Soraya Shamali, thanks very much and welcome to On Point.
Thank you, John, for having me today.
So there was, as we just said, this breaking of the dam on an online conversation that happened primarily, initially, and most broadly through Twitter and the hashtag YesAllWomen. Tell us what this hashtag meant and where it came from and what it was trying to say.
Well, I think the person who started the hashtag did it in response to another conversation that's fairly common and had turned into a hashtag called Not All Men. Because very often when episodes like this happen and women say, you know, this resonates with us, we understand what this is like, all women experience having to adapt every day to avoiding violence, and it's usually male violence. And so her response was, let's share these stories. Let's say how all women experience these things. And so the point, which many of us said on Saturday in particular, was not all men perpetrate these violences, but yes, all women live with the threat of them every day.
There were comments made. Jessica Valenti is one, for example, who wrote that Rodger, like most young American men, was taught that he was entitled to sex and female attention. So she actually puts it in terms of most young American men.
Yes.
Which seems to be one of the things that would prompt a hashtag that says not all men, that there is a sort of kind of response.
That's right.
Among regular guys and average guys, which I think is where the source of some of the difficulty of this conversation comes from, that it does feel to men who don't see themselves as aggressors or as feeling entitled feel that they're part being told that they're part of the problem. What about that? Is it everybody? And if not, how should that be sorted out?
So I think there are two related issues. There's the issue of sexual entitlement, which I agree with her is pervasive, not in American culture. I do a lot of transnational work, and it's pervasive globally. And that term, sexual entitlement, was actually recently used in a large-scale study done in Asia of domestic and sexual violence, where men themselves said that they regularly engaged in raping and beating women because they could, because they were entitled to. And I think that's clearly the subtext of what's going on here in the United States. If you look at young boys, we have a gendered self-regulation gap going into schools. We just expect girls to exhibit more self-control than we expect boys to. And it isn't a matter of biology if you look across nations, because that gap doesn't exist in many other nations. So if you look at the self-regulation gap, which is really encapsulated.
Can you unpack the term self-regulation gap?
Well, we just expect girls, for example, to be more polite, to be more quiet, to obey rules. And effectively, in expecting them to do that, mm-hmm. we really almost teach them to have submissive behaviors. Whereas boys, we say, and this is not just my opinion, I mean, anybody can go and Google this study, we say, oh, that's just boys being boys. We don't have the expectation that they can and should be controlling themselves. So if you look at school dress code policies, which is something I think everybody can understand, when somebody says to girls, cover yourselves up, don't wear those clothes, do not exhibit your bodies because you are a distraction to boys, what they're actually saying is you are supposed to be a thermidor for those boys who can't control themselves. When a school in New Jersey has all the girls pledge not to use obscenity as an example for the boys, they are saying exhibit more self-control than these boys are capable of exhibiting.
Let's define some terms because I think we'll be using them a lot. And you've okay. used the term entitlement a couple of times. So define as precisely as you can what you mean by entitlement as in this context and in this culture.
All right. So I believe that in the ways we're talking about, entitlement is the belief that you are owed certain things by virtue of birth, really, right? So in this case, we're talking about sexual entitlement. The second corollary to that is what sociologists in the 90s, Michael Kimmel, termed aggrieved entitlement, which is when you see the violence in an act like what happened on Friday night. So the entitlement itself is, I am owed sex. I am owed control. I am owed power. And you can look at it two ways. You can either look at it on the basis of gender, or you can look at it on the basis of status. And if you look at it on the basis of status, in that higher status people enjoy more entitlements and have higher expectations of entitlement, the only conclusion you can come to from the perspective of men and women is that women are universally lower status, and so men feel entitled in disproportionate measure.
And the word misogyny.
The word misogyny is something I think that a lot of people get confused about. It actually means a hatred of girls and women. I would say it also means a hatred of what is feminine. It includes various aspects of culture, sexual discrimination, sexual objectification. Something very notable that I think confuses people is that women themselves practice misogyny against other women, and men are definitively anti-misogynistic if they set out to be, right? Mm-hmm. And we had a change in the definition of misogyny in one dictionary last year after Julia Gillard, the Prime Minister of Australia, was pushed out of office largely in a grossly sexist environment for the definition to include entrenched prejudice. The aspect of this that I think is missed in this conversation, particularly in regards to violence, is all of that I just discussed comes in the context of women's exclusion from positions of leadership and authority and culture. And we see that in media. We see it in sports. We see it in the distribution of capital. We see it in politics. We see it in education. And one category after another, women make up no more than 15%, and often much less than 15%, of the people who are defining culture.
So if thank you for the definitions on both of those. But if we're living in a world, which I think we are, where I'm virtually certain the majority of American men would say, no, I'm not a misogynist, they would, if
right.
they use that word or not. But more to the point, I think that they would not announce themselves being entitled and may be making that statement sincerely. And I get the sense that part of the argument from the other side is you don't know how entitled you are, and you don't know how damaging that fact is, and you need to wake up about yourself.
I think that's true. I think that's why the hashtag got over, you know, I mean, there were over a million tweets in something like 24 hours. There are so many ways that are invisible in our culture that women adapt to avoiding violence. There are very high costs, right? So the simplest example that I gave when I was tweeting this weekend was that when I walk with my husband, who's 8 inches taller than I am, he regularly says, slow down, it's not a race. And it was only recently that I had to really stop and say, you know, you have not been avoiding street harassment your entire life. I mean, for women, it's not uncommon to have a story like mine. So I was 9 the first time on the street someone threatened to rape me using the word rape, and I didn't know what it meant. I was, you know, 11 the first time somebody hurled an obscenity at me because I didn't smile. I was 15 the first time somebody grabbed me to get a good look at me, and I punched him in the throat. I was 32 when a police officer pulled me over in my car and had me get out so that he could teach me how to strap in my children's car seats, and I was wearing a bathing suit. I mean, I have 50 of those stories, and my daughters, who were teenagers, have already been followed. You know, they've already been catcalled, which is a whole other matter, the language of catcalling. But I don't believe that most men are going through time and space having these experiences and thinking that it's just normal. And that's just one cost. I mean, you know, we can't travel the same way. Our tourist map, as Lauren Wolf recently said, is different because we need to avoid certain things. We have to incur financial costs. You know, we have to take taxis if we can afford them, or we have to go out of our way to avoid areas where we know we're going to be harassed, so it takes us twice as long to get to work. These are regular incorporations of violence.
All right, Soraya, stay with us. We're talking about misogyny in the wake of the killings in California and the conversation that has emerged from that tragic event. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. We are talking about misogyny and the big discussion that was kicked off in the wake of the killings in California. We're joined this hour by writer and activist Soraya Shamali. And Soraya, I just said this is, you know, this is something that maybe the point of this is that it's a conversation that needs to be happening with men. I framed it that way. Is that the way to have this framed? Is this conversation the sound of one hand clapping and you need to bring men into the conversation?
Well, I think there are two aspects. One is women themselves need to speak openly about their experiences, which is happening. Clearly that's happening. We have now language that we didn't have 30 years ago that enables us to share these experiences. So, you know, because of feminist activism that happened in the 70s and in the 80s, we have words like sexual harassment, domestic violence, trigger warnings. Those didn't exist before. And that language is now available to everyone. It's not isolated in pockets of feminist space. And that's important because what we experience very often as women is extreme isolation with these things. So when I began talking personally and publicly about sexual violence or domestic violence, it was shocking to me how many women I knew who hadn't really considered this before thought, oh, you know, actually, that happened to me. Hmm. When I was 15, you know, a man pulled me into a corner on the street and I fended him off, and then I'd never told anybody. I didn't tell my parents, or, you know, I experienced this in college or when I was traveling abroad. And it isn't until someone says it out loud that we can then have a conversation. The second part of that, of course, is to say to men, when we say these things, what happens is we're belittled. It's trivialized. It's marginalized. And
in what form? Give me an example of trivialization.
So not all men. That's the perfect example of gaslighting, right? That's the perfect example of saying, we're going to shift the conversation right now because what you're saying, it's more important to talk about us, right? You don't have a space, women, to actually talk about your experiences. We're going to say it's how we feel or how we're responding.
Does that response not depend on the way that the point is initially made? And as again, I was quoting Jessica Valenti in the beginning, saying that most American young men are socialized a certain way, which sounds can easily come across to a man. And, you know, I can't take my gender out of this conversation. I'm one,
right,
or the other, so I guess I have a dog in the fight to some degree. That it can easily sound like you, sir, are part of the problem, and so is your father, and so is your grandfather, and so are all of your male sons.
Right.
And that's a tough thing to hear, particularly if you don't think of yourself that way. I'm saying it's not part of the response that you're hearing, not necessarily an effort to shut you up, which I think is what you were saying, but is actually in a spontaneous and honest instinctive reaction. Wait a minute, you're accusing me of something darn nasty that I don't think I'm guilty
right.
of.
Right. So I think, listen, I'm a professional feminist. All I have to do to be hostile is walk into a room, right? So if men are responding that way, I can understand the emotional response. What the hashtag indicated very clearly was that women are fed up of that response, right?
Yes, all women.
You need hashtag. Mm-hmm. You need to listen to us, right? When we say we don't feel safe on our neighborhood streets at night, don't ignore us. When we say that we have, you know, when a person says to his sister, for example, "You're so spoiled. Why are you joining a gym?" Right? He's not pausing to think that something like 24% of women in this country will not exercise outside because they're avoiding harassment. That is a huge cost to us, right? And so we join gyms if we can afford it, and then we're made fun of for doing something like that, right? If I walk fast, it's not because I'm always in a rush. It's because I don't want to have people stop me.
But just and, to, I actually want to bring in another guest shortly, but just to come back to the point then of where is the interaction where you feel that if you actually were to make the argument that, listen, I'm joining a gym because it's not safe to go out and exercise at night, where do you experience a belittling response to that?
Well, the example that I gave you, which is of a man, for example, mocking his sister, is a real example.
It's
right?
real. Mm-hmm.
It's real. That happens all the time, right? If a woman wants to park close to entrances and her boyfriend says, "Oh my God, you're so lazy, can't we just park here?" It's because she's been conditioned to know that she has to get in as quickly as possible, right? It's not in the purview of most men's experiences. And I need to say here, I'm qualifying this. We're using very binary terms, which generally I don't like. Because the experiences we're talking about are seriously affected by race, by sexuality. You know, the most harassed and marginalized people are members of the LGBT community. And, you know, women who are living with the magnified effects of race and sex in their bodies, right? These are not things that can be separated. And you could see that actually in Elliot Rodgers, in his expression. It was deeply sexist, deeply racist. And people somehow think those are separable, and they're just not.
Well, let's that's a good point to bring in our next guest is David Futrell. And he is a blogger. He blogs at a site called We Hunted the Mammoth. And he tracks and discusses what is referred to as the men's right movement and pickup mm-hmm. artist sites and communities online. David Futrell, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So as Soraya Chamali just pointed out, Elliot Rodger was a subscriber to that ideology that's represented by those sites, that point of view, that philosophy. And to people who are not visitors to that or subscribers, it's kind of surprising that it's there and how well-formed and focused it is. Talk to us about what it is that he belonged to. What's that community online and its beliefs and its language?
Well, it's a rather amorphous kind of community of blogs and forums that I basically call the new misogyny online. Part of it is men's rights sites. Part of it is pickup artist sites. Roger wasn't actually a member of either of those particular branches of this misogyny, mm-hmm. though he shared much of his ideology with members of those groups. He was part of a sort of a stranger and in certain ways more extreme manifestation of this, which is called the incel community. And incel is a kind of insidious term that stands for involuntarily celibate.
Mm-hmm. It's a term that one embraces, or is it? It's a lament.
It's a term that these guys actually embrace, mm-hmm. and obviously, what that does is it's rooted in this male sexual entitlement, the idea that that sex is something that is essentially owed to them.
And therefore they're being cheated of something owed to them?
They're being cheated out of it by someone else, that someone else is rendering them celibate. And this is, of course, the running obsession in Rogers' book-length manifesto, is that he's a virgin and he has been rejected by women, and that this is an injustice against him, and that he needs to take his revenge against it, against the women of the world, and some of the men as well, though most of his ire is directed at women. And indeed, his manifesto ends with an elaborate fantasy of killing all women in the world and by putting them in concentration camps, and literally standing in a tower above the concentration camps, watching, as he put it gleefully, as the women starve to death. So that's obviously a very extreme manifestation of that particular ideology. But I think that entitlement comes out in a lot more subtle ways that I think that extend out from this sort of misogynistic culture online and into the daily lives of a lot of guys who wouldn't necessarily think of themselves as misogynistic. I think that a lot of guys complain that they get put into the friend zone by women, that they have female friends that they're very nice to, that they're courteous with,
But the sense of entitlement that Soraya Shamali was describing would as applied to that, would mean that that an injustice was being done to them.
Right, that they feel that they've given their female friends attention and respect and all these sorts of things, and that essentially that the women therefore owe them a sexual or romantic relationship.
As we know, Roger posted a lot online before his killing spree, in which he talked about his hate for women and this plan to punish them. Here is a short clip from one of these videos, and be advised, this is his voice, and it's not going to be pleasant.
You girls have never been attracted to me. I don't know why you girls aren't attracted to me, but I will punish you all for it. It's an injustice, a crime, because I don't know what you don't see in me. I'm the perfect guy. And yet you throw yourselves at all these obnoxious men.
So clearly, you know, it's tricky to try to read the mind of somebody you haven't met, especially somebody who's dead now. But clearly, I get that sense that he feels that he was being cheated, that there was an injustice in his life. But I also felt that you said, David Futrell, that he's not just his action, but his sense of the philosophy was far more extreme than is actually represented on the websites. That in fact he may be giving these websites a bad name, not by his action, but even by the way he construed their thoughts. Is that what you were saying?
Actually, not really. No, I mean I think that he's actually what he says what he said publicly on in his video and on the various websites or on the he posted on two websites that I know of, a bodybuilding forum that's a fairly misogynistic place, and also on this website PUA Hate, which is given over to a lot of incels. A lot of what he said was actually rather typical of those sorts of message boards. And what he just said, what you just quoted him saying in that video, is not that far out of line with what a lot of these people.
Well,
let me
put this question to you then, because part of Soraya's point, part of the conversation that we've been having, is that the pervasiveness of these attitudes is universal. That to some degree, all American men enjoy a system that provides them with entitlement. I think that's how Soraya would let me sum it up that way. And I want to ask you whether these groups. Whether there's a clear line in your mind between these groups and the larger population of men in America, or is this a very, very broad-based movement, and it's sort of everybody who's male is, if not a subscriber, is close to this kind of thinking?
No. I think what it is...
I guess, let me simplify, because that was a very complicated question, and I want to save time. Are these guys outliers?
I think yes and no. I mean, they are outliers in that they're obsessed with this to a degree that most guys are not obsessed, and they're bitter and angry about it. A great deal of their perception of themselves is that they're victims, and they do have this sense of aggrieved entitlement that you were talking about earlier, and this also extends, I think, to most men's rights activists and to the pickup artists that we were talking about also.
But is a fringe? I'm asking, are they a fringe group?
These particular people are a fringe group, but this overall attitude, the overall entitlement, is their ideas are coming out of ideas that are sort of an extreme manifestation of ideas that are very widely shared. And by lots of men in society, and some of them by almost all men in society, and that these sorts of things show up in women's lives all the time. One thing that I sometimes write about on my blog is women's the reactions that women get to when they respond negatively to men's messages on dating sites. So if a man sends, first of all, men are continually sending women these really crude sexual messages. But even if a woman replies fairly politely to a message, and even if the original message from the man is polite, if she turns him down, she often ends up getting, you know, long, angry screeds about and what a dirty slut she is and so on and so forth.
And is anybody crying foul on this besides yourself?
Well, I think there's a growing awareness of this spreading. I think partly it's that women are sharing these stories with one another and saying, hey, you know, and that women are getting these messages, and they're discovering that other women are getting these sorts of messages too. There's a website that actually just started up that details, I think it's called When Women Refuse. Which details actual sort of worst-case scenario, true stories of basically worst-case scenarios when women refuse sex, which often mean that they get attacked. A couple hours after Elliot Rogers' rampage on Friday, there was another case in California where a man shot at several women who had refused to have sex with him.
We are discussing misogyny and the big response to the killings in California. You can join this conversation. Has the outpouring of personal stories in the wake of this violence surprised you, or do you recognize it all too well? How do we address the issues being brought up? This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking about misogyny and about the big discussion prompted by the brutal killings in California. You can join this conversation. How do we move forward with this discussion? And can we all get on the same page as to what misogyny is and how widespread it is? And even if we can't, can we figure out a way to stop the violence against women? We're joined this hour by writer and activist Soraya Shamali, and I'd now like to bring into the conversation another voice, Robert Heasley, who is a professor of sociology at Indiana University, Pennsylvania. He studies masculinity and gender and is former president of the American Men's Studies Association. Robert Heasley, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, John. Thanks.
I want to, Robert, go to some callers and let you and Soraya respond to some of this. So let's go first to Paul, who is calling in from Concord, Vermont. Hi, Paul. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. I'd like to speak a little bit to the context of this conversation. The focus of my work is race and racism, but this is a very similar conversation. And what's playing out is that, and I'm thinking of the question you've asked a couple times about the blogger who said most men. And what's happening is we're not understanding, I think, in the conversation that, like racism and other forms of oppression, sexism is it's a system. It's not just individuals operating. Mm-hmm. And that system impacts us internally. It impacts us, our interpersonal relationships. It impacts our institutions, and it impacts our entire, and it's infused into our entire culture. So when we back away and look at that as a male in our society, as a white, as a person in our society, of course I'm infused with attitudes of white supremacy in terms of race. And I don't mean white supremacy in terms of the way we think of the skinheads or the Klan. I mean the assumption that whiteness is better. And just as I'm infused with ideas of male supremacy, and I may not know most of that, but it's very clear to women who are experiencing me. And so when they make that comment that most men, I don't necessarily take it personally because I'm operating within this system. And
I see.
I think it's really important to keep in mind that sexism, like racism, is about power.
Thanks, Paul. And that's a really, really good way to put it is to have the conversation without taking it personally, which may be a struggle and a stretch for some of us. But Robert Heasley, what about that in terms of how this conversation is sustained in terms of having it take place in a way that men who don't think that they're bad guys are willing to have a conversation in which women are saying that there's a big problem of misogyny and that they may be part of it?
I think that there's a lot going on here with all of this. One is, you know, as Soraya has pointed out so well, it's, you know, we're a culture that's infused with misogyny. And so when men say not all men, it's absolutely true. Not all men do these acts. But all of us, men and women, are a part of systems, as your caller just said, that have us form ideas of relationships, have us assume qualities of relationships that build an assumption of privilege and tolerance. And I think the big point for me is that there's such a high tolerance for boys will be boys. That's how boys are. These are how guys are. And the message to women then is protect yourself from them. Try to understand them. Try to figure them out so you can arrange your life in a safe way. And right. And then it's systemically supported institutionally by, you know, by religion, by all kinds of systems that reify sort of male privilege and male
yes.
status.
But we're all familiar with the conversation where a white person will say, I don't have a racist bone in my body. And say
but
so
we,
very.
But we live in a way, but we live in a racist culture, and I think that separation is important.
But would say so with all sincerity and with all goodwill, mm-hmm. and and others will raise eyebrows and say, "You do, you just don't know it to a certain extent," which is a very difficult conversation, I think, to have. So I guess I'm asking both you and Soraya, but start with you, Robert. How do we have the conversation to in such a way that it can be productive and move forward and not? And not cause people to become defensive?
I think cautiously and respectfully. Those are the two words that came to mind when I was listening to Soraya's insights. And, you know, it's cautious in terms of saying, okay, how can I word this in a way that's going to lead to a deeper conversation as opposed to an accusation? And I think that once we get accusations back and forth, and it's so popular in so many forms of media, women will say men are rapist, and men will say women are feminist, crazy, you know, radicals. And it shuts down any possibility of understanding the complexity of the issues. And internally, you know, many of us males will say, you know, I work hard in my life and to make sure that the world is a more equitable place with women and more respectful and ends violence. But I'm also can't deny that I'm still living in a culture that's systemically reinforcing a particular type of power by men over women. And so it's separating those things out. And so when I hear women sort of saying, we want to be heard, it's time we get heard. I need to step back and say, absolutely, tell me more, as opposed to,
well, that's
you
interesting
are heard,
that you gave that
about?
Answer to the question I was going to ask Soraya, which is, and Soraya, I understand that you bring a great deal of nuance to this. As you said, there are several dimensions. There's social class and there's race, and that this isn't just a problem of men talking to women. That's also a complication of women talking to women. So given all of that, allow me to simplify with my question, which is, in terms of the conversation between men and women, What is the useful and productive way for men to respond to this, to take part in this conversation?
Well, I think that the point that was just made, the distinction between people as individuals and the systems that we live with, has to be in people's consciousness. That really is an extremely important distinction that has to be made. So that, for example, when I speak to a room full of high school students, it is the first thing that I say, because I realize that when I'm talking about the history of racism and of homophobia and of sexism, it's going to feel as though I am indicting a certain group of people, young mm-hmm. white boys, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not the point of the conversation. The point of the conversation is to say, all right, this is the system we've created, but we can also change this system through awareness. I think it's extremely difficult, particularly when you focus on gender, because the nature of the privilege extends deeply into interpersonal relationships and is resident in homes, right? It's entirely possible for example, a white family to not evidence racism in their interpersonal relationships, but to live with the day-to-day sexism that is part of gender stratification and the way our society is structured. It's much harder to come to terms with how it functions in your own life, how it functions in your schools, how evident it is in religious structures. Those hit close to home, you know. But in order to have those conversations, you have to acknowledge the things that we're talking about.
Let's bring in Brittany from Enid, Oklahoma. Hi, Brittany, you're on Point.
Hi, John. I echo what Soraya is saying. I've experienced a life riddled with the vents of fending off misogynists. I'm to a point now where I'm experiencing anger. I get angry every time I hear women being taught to huddle together, walk fast, lace your teeth in between your fingers, and not a tenth of that energy and attention is put in conditioning men not to behave that way. Ultimately, the men are the only ones in a position to ensure that these things don't happen. I mean, it goes back to the old Spider-Man adage, with great power comes great responsibility. Men are stronger, they're bigger, and the responsibility needs to be more on their shoulders, too.
Interesting yeah. point, that the responsibility is more on men, then.
Well,
I just want to nail that. Brittany, you're absolutely saying that the responsibility yeah. is more men's?
I mean, ultimately, if you're telling me, if you don't want a person to get raped, who's in the best position to stop that?
All right, total clarity on that. Thanks, Brittany, for your point. I'd love to have both Robert and Soraya respond to that. Robert, why don't you go first?
If I could. That's great. It's an incredibly important point. And it goes back to Soraya. One of the things that Soraya talked about early in the program was how we raise boys. And, you know, and there's a lot of research that's been done by Bill Pollack at Harvard and Kinlan and Thompson in their books Real Boys and Raising Cain about how we raise boys to shut down around emotional intelligence. And I'm really big on looking at how we raise males in our culture, but also how we interact as adult males in our culture with a lack of intimacy, a lack of support. So males grow up and experience a lot of sense of desperation for intimacy, a lot of confusion about how to play it out. And for many males who don't want to participate in that part of male culture, which is misogynistic, which is the rape culture, the threatening culture of masculinity, there's a way in which we retreat to the shadows of masculinity and live quieter lives. We're nice guys. What we need to do for both men and women is to begin raising our boys to be actively engaged in emotional consciousness, in how to have intimate relationships among boys, how to have intimate relationships across gender that isn't sexualized, that isn't dominating, power-driven. And it starts not just by men getting involved in it, but men and women revisioning what we can do with raising.
Soraya, what about that?
And reinforcing males.
The point of whether it's in men's hands, this topic.
Well, I think very largely, I think the point of power is hugely salient. I mean, the way we live right now, I would say that the majority of boys feel tremendous pressure in our culture to strip themselves of empathy, because empathy is mm-hmm. feminized, right. And feminization is a degradation. And so boys are struggling with these expressions, and a lot of that comes from the model, the behavior that they see modeled around them. But, you know, I think we need to address this issue of early childhood interactions, because I'll just give a brief example of everything we're talking about in a vignette. So one of my daughters used to build castles every morning in school when she was in preschool. And every morning for months, there was a boy who knocked the castles down. And his parents were there, either one or the other. And my husband and I were there, either one or the other. And in every instance, we felt that his parents should be teaching him not to do that. There were other parents teaching their children not to behave that way. But every time he did it, his parents' response was, oh my gosh, boys will be boys. Oh my gosh, boys and girls are so different. Oh my gosh, it's just so tempting. And every time they said that and they didn't stop him, I was then in the position, or my husband is in the position, of trying to teach our child to avoid this little microcosm of aggression. And I realized, you know, hold on a minute. I am teaching my child to keep herself safe, you know, to put her body in between the boy and the castle. All of this dynamic was that entitlement that we're talking about. She was responsible for controlling his behavior. And my daughter was unaware of that. And his parents were unaware of that. And it struck me that they needed to be aware of that. And so I shared my opinion. That happens every day a million times a day, right? And so those little interactions accrue over time. And we end up with these systems.
Let me play something that took part in April as part of the White House's task force to protect students from sexual assault. The White House put out a public service announcement that featured actors Benicio del Toro, Daniel Craig, and Dulé Hill, and Seth Meyers, in which they ask men to stand up and be allies against sexual assault.
If I saw it happening, I speak up.
If I saw it happening, I'd never blame her. I'd help her.
Because I don't want to be a part of the problem. I want to be a part of the solution.
Robert Heasley, is that a new trend? Are we going to hear more of this?
Yeah, it is a trend, and it's a wonderful trend, I think, in terms of a lot of things. One is the White House itself and leaders taking on that issue and saying we don't need to do this anymore, as well as integrating, you know, gays and lesbians and bisexuals and now transgenders into military, evening the playing field so that there's incredible amount of consciousness that we're all commonly human. But also the other piece of it is the message to how we raise boys then is how do we raise boys to fit into a culture where being male isn't given that you're going to have more power or you have rights to women's bodies. You have the rights to pick on and demonize gays and lesbians, et cetera. So it's really that consciousness that, again, Soraya was talking about in terms of the need to revision masculinity itself and male relationships. It also, I just want to note, I was picking up on what David was saying about the websites that certainly Ali was going to were places where the volume of misogyny is raised to such a heightened level. And I was on those sites this morning just looking at the kind of discourse that was going on. And it's pretty appalling. But for people that are vulnerable, for males who don't feel adequately male, which is core to his identity, he doesn't adequately male because he didn't have a woman. He projects that all other men are doing better than him, and he's angry at women for not putting him in the status of other men. And we need to change that image.
Let me bring in Reese. I believe I'm pronouncing Reese or Rice. I'm not sure. Is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi. You're on point.
Is it Rice? Right, it's Reese.
Reese, okay. Sorry. Reese, welcome to the program.
Nobody can get it right. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to sort of add a voice to this conversation. I'm a genderqueer person who generally presents in a masculine way. People usually read me as a male gendered person. And I transitioned when I was in my late teens. And I have to say that as someone who was raised socially female and socialized as female and has the experience of learning to do exactly all of the things that you've been talking about, walking too fast so that I am not in an unsafe space, all of that, and not getting the early teaching of being raised male and what you were talking about with the little boy knocking down the castle, that kind of thing, I still experience that when people see me as male, they automatically assume that I am someone who holds a lot of power, and they give me power in a social way that is so uncomfortable for me. And I have to say that it's not just at the young age that this needs to change. Like, people who are adults need to realize that men are the ones who need to see the power that they're given and then not take it.
Reese, thank you for that point. I mean, it's fascinating that you can see this from both sides and still on a day-to-day basis. Saraya Shamali, we have about 40 seconds just to let you wrap up and respond to amazing firsthand experience.
Thank you. There is one thing that I wanted to address, which is this outlier issue. I think that deflects us from a real conversation about how pervasive these attitudes are and how easily they're expressed every day. So this was a murder-suicide. There are 12 of those every week. 95% of the perpetrators are men. 85% of the people who suffer are women. There are 66,000 calls on any given day to domestic violence hotlines. And these are all expressions of gender-based violence. And when you couple that with the levels of sexualized violence that we know exist, we should be calling it gender-based hate.
Saraya Shamali, thanks very much for joining us. You're an activist and writer who covers feminism, gender, and more. Robert Heasley, thanks to you as well, a professor of sociology at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.